It's time for another episode of Just a Bit Outside with your hosts, Stark and Massaro.
Way back, Blue Jays win it! Touch the ball, Joe! Brett Favre! Touchdown, Green Bay! Bless you, boys! What a game!
We are live! Welcome to the show on a massive week, an exciting week. And this time next week, we will all have our brackets in our hands, and I cannot wait. But first, lots of great sports that we will touch on today, including the Arnold Palmer Invitational wraps up with diabolical conditions. Major League Baseball has to cancel games. College basketball starts their conference championships. The NFL Combine takes place, and the Brier is underway. But first, Mike, how was your week?
Stark, good to see you. Pretty quiet week on this end in anticipation of March Madness beginning and the Players' Championship this weekend, so it'll be a good weekend of TV watching. Not much going on this end. There was a big wrestling pay-per-view Sunday night, so that was...
Yeah, what was that one called?
It was AEW Revolution.
Ooh.
Which, you know, was the highlight of the weekend, so a good 4 or 5 hours well spent.
What was the big match?
Well, the main event was for the title. It was the champion Hangman Page against Adam Cole. And Hangman retained his title. So a good night in the squared circle.
That's exciting. That's really exciting. You know what? It was an exciting weekend, too, because I feel like spring is in the air. I'm not sure if you felt that. But down here in southern Ontario areas, starting to warm up a little bit. I mean, my rink has completely melted. There is water and muck everywhere. And I guess it kind of meant it was time to start doing a little bit of spring cleaning or start getting set for spring cleaning. And I had to get a couple things done around the house. But here's the deal, Mike. I'm no handyman. I don't know about you, but I'm not really good at anything around the house. In fact, I actually hired a handyman to come over and fix something for me outside my house. But it's really embarrassing to be the not so handy handyman guy, because all I really do is just hold the ladder. You know, I'm hold the ladder guy. Like, hey, bud, can you just hold that ladder for me while I climb up 30 feet and try to fix something for you? The other guy I am is, hey, can you pass me that wrench? That's me. I'm the one. What kind of screwdriver do you need again? Starhead? I think this is the right one. I don't know. I'm not very good at this. I've never been handy, and I'm not going to start now. I think I'm past my prime. It's like, you know, at 40 years old, you don't start learning to play the guitar either. You just admit that you can't do it. But the other problem is I don't really have the right tools. So like when my father-in-law comes over, he's always fixing things around the house, and he must just be so disappointed in his daughter's choice of men, because she's with some guy that doesn't even know how to, you know, fix a light bulb or screw something in or hang a picture. I can't do anything. I watch sports. I'm a sports psycho, as we talked about. That's what we do. So, I mean, like, he'll ask me for certain tools, and then I say, like, I don't even have that. And he says, what? You don't have a 16-inch jigsaw in your garage? And I know on the drive home, he just laughs at me to his wife. Like, can you believe Stark doesn't even have the right tools? He must be such a loser. I mean, I guess I should do a whole tool upgrade. But, you know what? If something breaks, I'd rather just order a new one on Amazon so it shows up the next day and then just glue it to wherever it needs to go.
Well, I think you know what you're getting for your birthday next year or Christmas.
Father's Day.
You'll be getting some tools.
Are you handy?
I mean, I'm not going to be putting my services out there, but, you know, I can get things done. But, you know, if I need somebody more experienced, I would probably call my brother first or, you know, a tradesperson that knows what they're doing.
Do you own a tool belt?
Well, you don't need a belt.
I'm asking if you own a tool belt.
I do not own a tool belt, no.
Okay.
I have plenty of tools in the garage, but I don't need to wear them on a belt.
I could just picture you, you know, strolling around the neighborhood with your tool belt on. You need that fixed, lady? I'll fix it for you. I got a screwdriver right here. Need a hammer? Right here. Got it on my trusty old tool belt.
What is this, Home Improvement? I don't think so, Tim.
You could be Al. But the other thing I did this weekend, I went to a Leafs game, and it was awesome. I mean, it was great to be back. It was great to see people. It was great to be annoyed with people again. I mean, there was a lot of overserved fans, people just getting up from their seats in the middle of the play all the time. You know, that drives me nuts. I'm not going to go back into it. I've talked about it lots of times, but people just don't respect other fans and don't respect the way the game is. But the game itself was fun to watch. I mean, it was obviously stressful as a Leafs fan. They got the lead, and then they blew it in the third period. I mean, there's big question marks around their goaltending and their defense as a whole right now. But I mean, as for the actual game, you don't realize it, I guess. You know, I've watched so much hockey on TV the last 2 years, and I haven't been to as many games for obvious reasons, but you don't realize it when you do watch it on TV, how fast the game is. And I get why Americans, mostly, they always say, you know, if you're a hockey fan, or if you're not a hockey fan, I should say, you got to go to the game live to really get the speed and get how the game acts and how amazing of a sport it actually is because of that speed. Every player on both teams Saturday night, they can skate like the wind. They can handle the puck with so much skill. All the chops, the goons, they're gone from the game. They're not even around anymore. It's all skilled players. The only problem with that is there's zero physicality in the game anymore, which isn't great. I mean, I can't even really recall one big hit on Saturday night that actually happened in the game. But I know that will change come playoff time as that intensity ramps up and there's more scrums after the whistle. But these two teams, you know, they were speed hockey, and it was really fun to watch and fun to be back in the rink.
Well, that's good. And, you know, 82 game season, you're not going to be trying to kill each other every night, right? Like you said, you notice a difference, whether you're a hardcore hockey fan like yourself or a passive one, that things change in the playoffs. Spaces get a little tighter and it gets a lot more physical.
Yeah, but of course, I was down there with some college buddies and, you know, we were just tying one on, to be honest with you. It was great. But we're using mybookie.com. Check it out if you haven't. And we were placing some bets, and man, did we hit a beauty. So we all know John Tavares, he's really struggling right now, right? Hasn't really scored in 12 games, and everyone's on him, says his line's not good. He's the problem. So we all jumped on MyBookie, and we bet John Tavares to score a power play point. It was like plus 200. First period, he comes down the wing. The Leafs are losing right now. They got the power play. And when they get the power play, we're all jacked up. We're like, here it comes. Here it comes. Now we're on the power play. We got a chance for our prop to hit. He came down, cut across, fired that shot, top shelf. So happy that the Leafs scored to tie up the game. Yes. But also jacked that our guy, John Tavares, got the power play point and our bet cashed. And it was a great feeling. I was so excited, and that's the beauty of betting on sports, because I was on an ultimate high. But hey, we've got a great show for you. We're going to jump into our T5 and play a fun game at the end. So stick around. We're coming right back after this break. Sunday in Southern Ontario, the sun was out. People were jogging on the sidewalks. Mike was wearing his muscle shirt, and it just made me want to golf and shoot my low score of the year. But then I turned on the Arnold Palmer Invitational, and that will be our T1. Bay Hill has long been called one of the toughest non-major courses on the PGA, and it showed why on Sunday. It quickly became a battle of which golfers would survive in order to determine the winner. And Scottie Scheffler had what it took to win the event, shooting even par for his second trophy in 3 starts. Mike, are we seeing a new star emerge on the PGA Tour?
Well, 2020 Rookie of the Year last year, or 2 years ago now, I guess, and 2 massive tournament wins. I think 2 of the more popular tournaments on tour that are not majors, the Waste Management and the Arnold Palmer, and he's won both of them now in under a month. And how many times can you say the winner shoots an even on Sunday to win a tournament? But
nuts.
That was kind of what the conditions provided them. The greens were slick. The winds were really heavy. And you saw a lot of guys shoot in the plus and fall off the lead. And, you know, my guy from our picks, Rory, looked real good after round one, shooting a 7-under. And then, you know, a couple, what was it, 72, an even par Friday, and then back-to-back 76s to close the weekend, plus eight, and finish one over. So it was not very kind to the golfers, but, you know, good job by Scotty Scheffler winning his second in a couple weeks.
But you know what, Mike, that's what I love about this tournament, and you know, it doesn't happen very often. I love this course. It's a U.S. Open style course, and it obviously had U.S. Open conditions on Sunday. Missing 4-foot putts was what was making it real challenging for these guys, because they were missing some short putts and still leaving themselves another 3 or 4 or 5 feet back, and they were really, you know, clutching that club, clutching that putter, trying to make those putts coming back, and that's when it becomes a challenge. I love when the guys can't stick the balls on the green and make them suck right back. It's tough to land the ball on the green, which makes it hard to make birdies, because then you're chipping on, and if you're chipping on to a glass green, it might just roll right back at. I want to see pro golfers frustrated. I love that type of golf. The final round saw 4 players shoot under par with an average score of 75.4, and only 10 players finished the tournament under par. It was clearly tough. The last time the winner on a PGA Tour event won in under par single digits was, of course, at the U.S. Open, which was won by Jon Rahm. So this doesn't happen very often, and I'm fine with seeing it every once in a while. The 17th hole, par 3, it seemed to be really challenging for these guys, protected by the water, protected by the bunker, wind was swirling, they weren't sure which way it was coming, lots of guys taking their time on the tee before hitting, and everyone was coming up short. It was just, the wind was moving too fast for them to figure out, am I going to go long and into the rough, or am I going to go short into the water? And they would land it in that bunker. And then we saw guys like Gary Woodland, of course, he eagles 16, takes the lead, comes up to 17, takes him 2 shots to get out of the bunker, double bogey, bogey on 18, he's done. He's out of it. So it's a challenging course. I like that. But my favorite hole, Mike, 18. It's so beautiful to look at. It's a long par 4. It forces the players to lay up if they don't have a drive right down the fairway. Plus, even if you do have a great shot down the fairway, that green kind of hugs the water, and the pin is stuck right at the back right corner. So you got to decide, am I going to go for it or not? Hovland, perfect example, he had to birdie 18 to tie. He's right down the middle of the fairway. He goes for that green. The wind gets him. He just lands on the fringe and one hops to stay right there. If he had another foot, that lands onto the green and rolls right up by the pin for an easy tap in, which would have forced a playoff.
Yeah, and Billy Horschel had a chance there on 18, birdie right. Putt, and yep. You know, he came up short as well. But I think it just kind of speaks to just how impressive Scheffler was, and you know, shoots a 68 4 under on Saturday to move himself from, he was what was he, around the 20s, maybe tie for 20th, and it put him up into fourth after a solid Saturday. Started out, I think, bogey birdie, and he kind of exchanged those for the first few holes, but then finishes with 6 consecutive pars to finish off the round, which is kind of something you'd expect at the U.S. or the British Open.
Yeah. How often do you say 6 consecutive pars is a good thing?
Exactly, but it just speaks to how solid of a round he played in very difficult conditions. And now, you know, he wins $2.1 million, just over $2.1 million there. Ooh. From the Arnold Palmer, and you know, just under $1.5 million from the Waste Management for 2 wins, and now his top spot in the FedEx standing. So good month for Scotty.
And he's one of those guys where just watching him, you think he kind of has an awkward looking swing. He's kind of got that leg kick that drags behind him after he twists his hips. But he is consistent, and he very rarely gets himself in trouble, which is something that kind of helps him at least stay in these top spots to have a chance to win. And really all you need once you're in those spots, is a hot putter. And this year, that's been the difference for him versus his first 2 years on the tour. It's been putting. He's now in the top 20 putters on tour, and he was able to hit some clutch putts this weekend, which really started, like you mentioned, on the back nine on Saturday. He was 24th position before shooting a 31 on the tough back nine at Bay Hill, which included the 21-footer for eagle on 16, and that vaulted him right up to the top of the leaderboard, and you knew he had a chance come Sunday. I mean, it's tough to win in bunches on the tour. Really, we haven't seen much of it since Tiger, and there's so many good players, so many good young players, which makes it even tougher. But he has to be a top five favorite this week at the Players, and I would even say for the Masters. Both these courses fit his game, great driving and strong putting. I think he's got a shot.
Yeah, and I just want to thank you for your text to me on Thursday after Rory shoots a 7-under. You're like, Rory, and I think I responded, still 3 rounds to go, man, long week. And sure enough, Rory is not the last man standing. So thank you for that. But yeah, looking ahead to the Players, I guess this is kind of considered the unofficial fifth major, if there was going to be one. But just for the people out there to understand the magnitude of this tournament, $20 million purse. It's probably the biggest purse on tour, I think, this season. Winner gets $3.6 million. But along with that, importantly, there's a 5-year tour exemption. So you're on the tour for a guaranteed 5 more seasons and a 3-year exemption to all 4 majors. So, you know, some significant substance riding on this tournament.
Yeah. And this is the PGA Tour's flagship event. It's their major. They don't control the US Open or the PGA Championship or obviously the Masters or British Open. So this is theirs. They control the way the course looks. They control the field. And it's a great tournament. Clearly my favorite tournament outside of the majors. You've got 16, 17, and 18. They're so beautiful to look at. Lots of water. There's lots of trouble out there for these guys to get in down the finishing stretch, especially on a Sunday when the crowds are big. I mean, we're going to have no Tiger. We're going to have no Phil, and that's fine. The field is just littered with top young players in the world, with multiple players having the chance to win this and actually become the number one player in the world rankings. So I'm excited to sit on my ass and watch some golf this weekend and see who comes out up top. Hitting onto that island green on 17, I'm sure we'll be talking a lot about it next week.
Most intimidating shot in golf? Hole? Shot? What do you think? One of them? It's definitely up there. It's definitely up there.
It's number 2. Do you know what the number 1 is? 12 at Augusta.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. In Amen Corner. Yeah, makes sense. Yeah.
As the interest in some big-time sports events kick off here in March, the MLB is keeping their news to the boardroom, as the lockout will be RT2. As of the start of this week, no formal deal had been reached between the Players Union and the MLB owners. Rob Manfred officially canceled the first 2 series of the season, and a fear that all of April baseball will be canceled shortly is starting to look like a possibility. Mike, is this labor dispute worth it to the players?
I don't know. I think both sides are looking for some significant changes, and it seems like they're starting to discuss some of those rules that they'd like to see changed ahead of the 2023 season. Regardless, I think, you know, it's tough. Once April hits, you look forward to opening day, but that's not happening. And, you know, from what you read and what you see on SportsCenter and in the news, it doesn't look like we're going to be playing baseball anytime real soon.
Yeah. The owners, they don't care about April baseball, just so you know that. I mean, most of the games aren't really full sellouts. You always hear the stories about opening day, full sellout, and then the next day they play the exact same team and there's half the people there. It's because in most of these places, the weather isn't really good in April. Some of these games get canceled. You end up playing doubleheaders in August. So the owners aren't too concerned with losing the first 2 series. They care about midsummer games. They care about playoffs. That's the time when they make their real money, and that's the only thing that matters to them. Owners have the leverage right now. Don't kid yourself. And they've been able to keep labor peace since 1994 when the World Series was lost. The players, on the other hand, they're going to make it seem like they're doing this for the love of the game and improving the game. But it's about money for them, too. The young stars coming up are losing control to the owners. The big contracts are going to more established veterans. I mean, look at Vladdy, for instance. The Jays kept him in the minors for as long as they possibly could to the very last day so that they could control him and delay his free agency, which would delay the big contract that they knew he was going to get and he's still going to get. But now they've got him for a couple extra years on that cheap deal. Players who have played for 10 plus years are now in the meat of their big contracts, and they're not going to want to hold out to help the young players up and coming or the players in the minors who could lose their jobs. We're talking about some players, Mike, who are going to start losing $100,000 a week, if not more. I don't care who you are. Eventually, you're going to say, enough's enough. Get me back out on the field. Look at the NHL players. They eventually said enough is enough. They sat out a full year and said, we'll never take a salary cap. And then eventually they took the salary cap. They needed to start playing. I don't think a salary cap is going to work in baseball, but the players are going to be forced to give something up because their hot button issues aren't enough to be able to keep them off the field. And they're going to eventually want to play and make some money.
Yeah, I feel like we're going to eventually get to baseball, but when is that going to be? I don't think, you know, anybody be willing to make a guess right now. It certainly seems that neither side's really giving much right now. I mean, you know, here we are first week of March or so, and we're 3 months into this now, which I think a lot of people forget, right? Because it is the off season, but the lockout took place in December and it's been in place since. So now, you know, talks have kind of continued for the past few days, but really nothing, it seems like they're getting anywhere, but, I don't know.
Yeah. And anyone, you know, when you see some of these players, I won't name names, but they're on social media or on the news saying, you know, Rob Manfred should be fired. He's a jerk. He's holding us out and all that. Stop. You clearly don't know what you're talking about. Rob Manfred is paid by the 30 MLB owners to be their puppet and give the bad news. You think it was his idea to lock out the players? No. He takes the deals back to the owners, says, here's what the offer is. The owners vote and they say, okay, Robbie, go back out in front of the microphone and say the first 2 weeks are canceled. I mean, this guy's just doing what he's paid to do. Like all commissioners, they shouldn't be taking the heat. But really, I mean, the players do make a good point about the game not being what it used to be. Baseball is not what it was. Home runs and strikeouts have kind of taken over the game and made it a lot different to watch. Games are way too long with lots of lulls in between action. We're talking about pitchers walking around. We're talking about batters getting out of the batter's box to fix their gloves and their jocks 20 times. I agree that eliminating the shift and adding a pitch clock is probably the right move. I think both of those rule changes will help the game move along and keep things interesting. I mean, but I look at it like right now with my kids. My kids play baseball. I love the game and I put them into it. But my son plays rep hockey and zero kids on his team play baseball. When I was a kid, every rep hockey player played rep baseball in the summer. That's what you did. Nowadays, these kids play lacrosse, basketball, golf. Some of them even play more hockey, and that's in Canada. Think about in the States. You know what those kids play? Football. They all play football now. Baseball is kind of dying off, and it's sad to see. And both of these sides, owners and players, need to figure something out before the game is completely gone and there's no pie to even split up.
Yeah, it brings up the, you know, on a, I guess, a smaller level, not to get into the, you know, the minutiae of everything, but 162 games, is that too many? You know,
I agree.
I feel it is. And I consider myself, you know, I like watching Jays games, and this is certainly come playoffs and down the stretch, their playoff baseball is great, but it is very difficult to stay engaged every day from April until the end of September, 162 games. And, you know, to your point with the attendances, yeah, you get opening day, you get Canada Day, you know, when the Yankees come to town or the Red Sox or some other big time player that people want to see for a weekend series, right? So, you know, is 162 games too many? I don't know. Maybe. It's hard to keep people engaged that long.
Mike, when I worked at the Blue Jays games, we're talking the years that they sucked. I mean, they were wearing black jerseys, for crying out loud. I had to go to every single home game, 81 home games, and I had to watch every single pitch. By June 15th, they were already out of the playoffs, and I still had the whole summer I had to go through. It was tough. So imagine, you know, fans trying to get them to come out to games when they don't matter. The game's not that exciting. It's a battle for owners and for teams to get fans.
Sure. And that, I mean, that's kind of the other point to this is, you know, for aside from what the four or five teams that make it per league in the American and National, how many of those teams come July are realistically zero chance of making the playoffs? And then you're just basically playing out 2-3 months of a season.
Exactly. But then on the other hand, if they expand the playoffs and add more teams like they're talking about, then it just cheapens the 162 games.
Yeah. Because
you got a team that might win over 100 games playing a team that only won 88 or 90, and it's a series, and you could be knocked out. And it's like, what do we play 162 for if we're gone in three games?
Yeah, it's one of those things, right? I don't think there's any immediate fix or right answer to it all.
Well, let's move to happy news. And it's March, baby. That means for the next 4 weeks, we will have meaningful college basketball games almost every night. And that will be our T3. This past weekend saw conference regular season champs crowned and a farewell night for Coach K at Duke. But Mike, do we want to start with your Wisconsin Badgers? Did they win the Big Ten, or what are we classifying this as?
They are co-winners of the Big Ten regular season championship.
So they just cut that trophy in half. Wisconsin takes half and Illinois takes the other half. Is that how they do it?
We would rather Illinois gets it. We don't want to see the trophy harmed. So you know we are the true winners. That's the age-old saying. No, Wisconsin won big Tuesday night against Purdue and then lost to Nebraska over the weekend, and Illinois won Sunday night, so they're co-regular season champions. It happens, and because of it, though, it kind of bung things up in the Big Ten conference championship ahead this weekend. So now Illinois is the one seed, Wisconsin's the two seed, and Purdue, who is, you know, a very good team,
yes,
is the three seed, and you know, we'll see what happens. So, yes, co-champs.
I mean, I believe we are in for one of the wildest tournaments in March Madness history. Upsets have been happening nonstop since the start of the season. The amount of teams that have actually been the number one in the country, I think, is over 8 teams throughout the year. So it's crazy. And we discussed it on the last pod. The top 6 teams in the nation lost 2 weekends ago. This weekend, we saw ranked teams in the top 25 lose to non-ranked teams. I think there was about another 6. You had Duke losing. You had Michigan losing. You had Wisconsin. You had Alabama. All these top teams just falling off. It's going to be wild. I think it means there's more parity than the lack of superstar teams like we've seen in the past. And I think it's better for the game. It's going to be better for the tournament.
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely love college basketball. I think the two halves, the drama behind it all, Sister Jean and Loyola Chicago, they're back in. So that's always a feel-good story, and hopefully they can win a couple games. But it's just a great couple weeks of storytelling and seeing the emotion that these players feel, and you know, having full stadiums and everything. It's must-see TV, and you know, the first 4 days of the tournament, Thursday through Sunday, I mean, from 12 noon until about midnight, there's so much greatness to watch.
And it really does start this week because of the conference championships. And they're essentially mini March Madness tournaments. And they mean so much to the players and schools because they're playing those teams that they rival against all year long in every single sport. And it's very important to them win. Obviously, it gets you into the tournament and gets you a higher ranking. But you want to be hot going into the tournament and you want to beat these teams. And you were talking about the Big Ten. The conference I'm going to be watching, Mike, is the SEC. They obviously play this weekend. They have 7 teams in the top 25 right now. Auburn clinched the top spot going into the weekend. They have a record of 27-4, but you got to watch out. Tennessee, 23-7, Kentucky, 25-6, and Arkansas, 24-7. all with legitimate chances to win the conference tournament, which would put them in a top spot, either a one or two seed come Sunday night on the selection show. Not to mention, you got Bama. They're ranked 25th in the country, and they're number six in their conference. 25 overall, but six in their conference going into the tournament. They got an uphill battle just to get to the semifinals in their tournament. I could see three teams from the SEC that have one or two seeds in March Madness next weekend. It's going to be great to see this weekend how it goes. The quarterfinals in the SEC Conference Championship, here's what you got. You could have Florida versus Auburn, LSU versus Arkansas, South Carolina versus Tennessee, and Bama versus Kentucky. Is this a football or basketball conference? This is clearly the best conference in all of college sports.
Yeah, it promises to be a great conference tournament. A couple others I'm going to watch. ACC, I think Duke are obviously the heavy favorites there, but Notre Dame's had a real good season. UNC, they're kicking around. They probably got into the tournament and with a good showing here. Big 12, probably going to be between Kansas and Baylor, who are both probably one and two seeds, if all shakes out as expected for the bracket. And, Pac-12, Arizona, UCLA should be a good one. And the Big East, you got UConn, Providence, Villanova, all teams that are vying for seeding. So it's going to be good. There's going to be no shortage of excitement which way you want to go.
Yeah, I'm looking at kind of the final top 25 ranking. We look at the top five. They got Gonzaga still at number one. They kind of lose out on this big weekend that's happening around the nation as all these teams mentioned playing in their conference championships. Gonzaga doesn't really get that too much because they're in a crap conference. Mm. They're obviously going to just walk right through the championship. They'll get a number one seed. They miss out, though, on that intense feeling of playing in a big game this weekend, which all these other teams are going to have going into March Madness. Gonzaga won't feel that till Thursday or Friday on the first weekend when they play their first game, which will probably be against the 16 seed, which lots of people have claimed that's why Gonzaga never gets to go too far, although we've seen it a little bit more in the last few years. But they just don't have that strength of schedule playing tough teams, and they don't have the tough tournament. Number two seed, same thing. Arizona, they won't have too much trouble in the Pac-12. Really, I think UCLA might be their only competition. Baylor in the Big 12, it'd be interesting to see if they can hold on to a one seed. But I think they got to win out this weekend to be able to hold on to one of those. You mentioned Duke. They had that disappointing loss to UNC. The stage was maybe too big with Coach K's night, but I expect them to bounce back in this ACC tournament. And then rounding out the number five team right now is Auburn. And we talked about what a challenge they're going to have in the SEC tournament. So really, it's going to be tough to predict who the number four team, the four number one teams are going to be until Sunday night, 5 minutes before selection show.
Yeah, and that will determine where things set. And then from Sunday onwards, we invest all of our time into bracketology.
And on that note, Mike and I are running the Jabo March Madness pool. So here's what you're going to want to do. Make sure you're following us on Instagram and Twitter. And later this week, we are going to post that our March Madness pool is now open. All you have to do is DM us back on Twitter or Instagram saying, "Hey, Stark, Mazzaro, I want to be in this pool and I want to kick your asses and win that big money." And all we'll do is we'll send you back the link and you can sign up. So make sure, watch out for our social media and sign up when you can. Now, the SEC was on full display this past week at the NFL Combine, and that will be our T4. The NFL does it right and doesn't care what else is going on in the sports world, as they held their combine for all draft eligible players in Indianapolis. And the weekend was all about speed, as players of all different sizes were crushing the 40-yard dash. Mike, before you break down the news and notes in the NFL, what was your 40 time?
Clock's still going, I'm not sure. They don't have a stopwatch that measures in hours. So, couldn't tell you, but, yeah, I mean, a good, uh, good job by the NFL and NFL Network of covering everything. It's, again, one of those things that's hard to follow every day, but lots of news and notes. Every team is there, coach, GMs, full slate of media from every kind of market. And it's been in Indianapolis for years, and they do a good job of it. So a good job. You know, a lot of Georgia defensive players highlighted themselves, and I'm sure will put themselves in conversations for first or second round picks. But a good time. And now the teams take that information, see what they can do. And, you know, they got the draft April 28th through the 30th, where these, you know, future superstars, futures will be decided.
Yeah. And I broke this down based on offense as I watched it a little bit, looked into it. I did a lot of reading on it too, because I like to follow these guys. I like to follow these kids because I watched them a ton in college, and now they're going on to the pros, and I like to see how their careers evolve or fall apart, depending on what it is. So here's what I got. Best QB. I had Kenny Pickett out of Pittsburgh. I mean, who cares if his hands were slightly smaller than they should be when that news broke? He was the top QB in college, and he has the composure to continue his Heisman finalist ability into the pros. He also ran the 40 in 4.73. Gone are the days of slow pocket QBs. Best running back, Bryce Hall out of Iowa State. He recorded a next-gen state overall of 99. But it will be his ability to get those extra yards on third downs that teams will like. Running backs, they've kind of fallen in the draft lately the past few years. They're not going as high as they used to, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. But this guy might be worth jumping up to get. And then for wide receiver, I got Chris Olave from Ohio State. Rumors are swirling that this kid, who was the second best wide receiver from his school at one point, has jumped up to a top 15 pick this April. He's got video game smooth type of a receiver. He has breakaway speed. And actually, one catch in particular saw Malik Willis bomb a throw in the go route drill, and Olave chased it down for the best catch of the combine. Yeah, I was watching combine highlights.
That's okay, man. If a team comes calling, like your Bears, maybe you can provide some insight. Desmond Ridder as well from Cincinnati had a good combine. I don't know if he put himself into a first round conversation, but possibly, as there are some teams, you know, Pittsburgh, Denver, Washington, that are looking at potentially a quarterback change there. So through necessity or, you know, to bring in a younger guy. So he had a good combine as well. But that's kind of the gist of it. Like we said, now they take that information, and over the next few weeks, as things start to evolve with the franchise tags, which, you know, take into place now, and by the time we finish recording and our podcast airs, the deadline will have passed. So as of tonight, Monday night, three players have been franchise tagged as of right now. David Njoku, tight end from the Cleveland Browns, Jesse Bates, a safety from the Cincinnati Bengals, and Orlando Brown, offensive tackle from the Kansas City Chiefs. Imagine there'll probably be a couple more names added to that list by the deadline at 4 p.m. on Tuesday. And then after that, it's really teams need to get cap compliant ahead of the start of the new business year and free agency, which is Wednesday, March 16th. So free agency kicks off 4 p.m. next Wednesday, but teams have an exclusive window that they can start negotiating with unrestricted free agents as of Monday at noon. So you'll probably see a lot of these deals get broke next week, and I'm sure we'll get into that in due time. But exciting time.
Yeah, and I'm really curious just about the quarterbacks. Mm. What's going to happen with these quarterbacks? They're kind of all going to be, or they all have been rumored to be moving around, a lot of them, and where they're going to land, it's musical chairs. But I really don't think anything's going to happen with the quarterbacks until Aaron Rodgers makes his decision. Is he staying? Is he going? And if he's going, where is he going? He has to be the first piece to fall. And where he goes and what Green Bay gets for him, that'll open up the market, and they'll see what's going to happen. If they do trade him, it's going to be a situation where both sides are kind of happy. Do you know what I mean by that, Mike? Like, I could see it where Green Bay is going to be like, yeah, we got the best that we could for a great player. Thanks a lot, Aaron. And he's obviously going to be like, hey, I'm happy to be joining such and such team. And that's going to be this kind of weird dance of them splitting off. Or he comes back and he's the quarterback, and he's like, never wanted to leave, always wanted to be here. So I think that's the first thing that's going to happen. We're going to hear that first, and then you're going to start hearing about all the other quarterbacks. What's Russell Wilson doing? You know, is Kyler Murray moving? All that type of stuff. That'll be the next wave after Rodgers.
Yeah, I agree. And at this point, I just want a decision to be made one way or another. I've kind of prepared myself for either outcome, and I will accept either one.
Now, from fast-paced NFL to fast-paced curling for our T5, the Men's Canadian Curling Championship, known as the Brier, kicked off this week in Lethbridge, Alberta, with each province represented, plus an additional two wildcard teams to round out the group playing for their chance to represent Canada at the World Championships. Mike, our curling guru, break down all the action. And who should we be picking to win this year's Brier?
Good start after a few days in here at the Brier. Kevin Cooey from Alberta is probably the favorite going in. It sounds like this is going to be his team's last run. I think I mentioned in previous shows, either after the Scotties or the Olympics, these teams kind of build for these four-year Olympic runs. And then once the cycle is over, the Olympics have passed, you see a lot of reshuffling through the team. So it sounds as if this might be their last run at it. He's won four times, his team. I don't think any skip has won five Briars in history, so he's pushing for that. His team's 4-0 right now to start the week. Brandon Botcher, defending champs, they're 3-0 as Team Canada. Brad Gushue, fresh off a bronze medal in the Olympics, is 4-0 as one of those wildcard teams. And Brad Jacobs, another one to watch in Pool B from Northern Ontario, 2013 winner, are 3-1 as of Monday night. So, you know, the usual suspects are near the top of the leaderboard, and I imagine that will continue through the rest of round robin and into the playoffs this weekend.
I don't watch a ton of curling. I get most of my curling news from you and my mom, diehard fans. But I really actually want to talk about something I've talked about already regarding curling, and I've started to read about curling, and I'm not the only one bringing this up, about how Canada selects a champion and a team for international events. And there's some people not happy about the way it's going down. We've obviously had some mediocre showings at these world events recently. Many are questioning if this is the right way to crown a winner to represent your country moving forward. I mean, yes, Canada has the curling depth unlike any other country in the world. But when it comes to having your four best versus another country's four best, are we doing it the right way right now? I'm not sure. It's obviously Curling Canada agrees on this. They've changed the playoff format. They added wildcard teams. They even changed the pool structure over the last few years. But with 18 teams in the field, they're set to compete this week. It is still one of the greatest all-Canadian events, and the parties in Alberta must be rocking right now, as there is no shying away from the booze at Curling Bonspiels. And I guess that's really what it's all about at the Brier.
The Brier Patch. If you've never been to a Brier, the Brier Patch is the party zone. They usually have nightly concerts and food and drink. It's a good time.
On the bucket list, right up there with the Waste Management Open. But one thing I thought was actually really cool I caught this weekend was 59-year-old Glenn Howard, representing Ontario, I believe, who used to, anyway, work at the beer store.
Still does. I'm pretty sure he is still a manager. I don't know if he owns a store or he's a store manager up in Penetang.
Wow. So Canadian. A professional curler and works at the beer store. But now he's got his son, Scott, as his vice, which is really cool. And apparently, you know, obviously 59 is getting up there. They won the Ontarios without Glenn. I think he was out with an injury, but they brought him back from the Brier once they qualified. Tough decision. You got to have Pops back coming playing, but I think they're struggling right now. They're 0-3, but a real cool story to be playing with your son. We talked about it last week with LeBron possibly playing with his son. Glenn Howard's actually doing it.
Yeah, Glenn, I mean, he's been around the game for a long time. I think this is something like his 18th or 19th Brier he's been in, something incredible like that. He's had success with his brother. He used to be a vice or second for his brother Russ, who's on the broadcast team for TSN, and he's skipped his own team the past you know, 15, 20 years. Won two Briars as Skip in 2007 and 2012. And his team's kind of moved on in the past couple of years. He's had his son as a part of it. And, you know, it's a good story. And he's a good curler for the province. And nice to see them have another run here in the Briar this year.
Yeah, I'll be getting the info from my mom every night. She loves to text me when the games get heated and I flip them on. So I'll be following.
I'm going to have to give her a call and chat because...
You guys should start your own podcast.
Yeah, I think we should. I mean...
Stark's Mom and Mazzaro's curling podcast. I love it.
My circle doesn't talk much curling, so it's nice to speak with fellow fans.
Now, going into the Arnold Palmer Invitational, I was up 11-0 in our golf pick'em over our friend Mike Mazzaro, who openly begged on this podcast to add 1 point for any player to make the top 20. So I said, sure, Mike, we'll do it. And this is how it went down last weekend. I had Victor Hovland, who finished T2. I had John Rahm, T17. And I had Max Homa, who finished T17, for a total of 7 points. Mike had Haddon, who finished T2. McIlroy, who blew it, finished T13. And Matsuyama, who snuck in on a T20. So Mike also got plus 7 points. So the season series is now led by me at 18-7. And we move on to the Players' Championship at TPC Sawgrass with its famous Island Green on 17. All 30 of the top players in the FedEx Cup standings are playing, and 48 of the top 50 in the world. So let's get to our selections. And Mike, I believe you get to start us off. So where are you going?
No, I started last week. I took Rory.
Did you? Because, yeah, we're right. Yeah,
you know what? You gave me the point last year or last week. And you know what? You're welcome because you got two out of it as well, my friend.
Yes, I did.
But I'm pretty positive I took Rory first last week, so it goes to you.
The guy I have circled to go first overall, I'm taking him right now, and that is Colin Morikawa.
I'd like to retract my me allowing you to go first because that's who I was going to pick. You prick. You know what? I got to go with the hot hand. I'm going Scottie Scheffler.
Wow. Could he do it? That would be an unbelievable story. And as I mentioned, I think he's got to be one of the top five favorites, which is great. I'm going with past champion. He's been partying a little bit, having a good time, but it's time to get dialed in. I'll go with Justin Thomas.
I have a long list here. I'm trying to decide who I'm going to go with. I'm going Patrick Cantlay.
He looks like he should be a Players' Champion winner out there on the Island Green with that trophy. I'm going to someone who hasn't played well, but he steps it up for big tournaments, majors, and he wants this trophy as well. I'll go with Brooks Koepka.
My last pick, I am going to take Daniel Berger.
Ooh, the Berger fumbled a couple of weeks ago. Maybe he can get it back together and get himself a win. So follow our picks this week. It's going to be a great weekend of golf. But coming up after the break, we play your boy to find out who is on fire in the sports world. Mike, your boy has become one of my favorite games on the show. I love saying your boy, but it always allows us to brag about people in the sports world that needs their tires pumped. So let's start off with you first and find out who your boy is. And this weekend, Coach K had his last home game at Cameron Indoor Stadium, where he was embarrassed by his rival UNC, losing 94-81. He scolded the fans while saying his farewell speech. Mike, is your boy, Coach K, in the right mind frame to take this Duke team to a national championship?
$10,000 a ticket to be at that game, or more. I think roughly that's what they were going for. So a pretty penny. After 42 years at Duke, Coach Mike Krzyzewski, known as Coach K, is stepping down. He's retiring, 75 years old, does not look it. June 2nd of last year announced that this season would be his final and will be replaced by John Shire, assistant coach at the program for the past several years. all in all, over his 42 years at Duke, 5 national championships, second all time to obviously John Wooden and his 10, 12 Final Four appearances, 15 ACC tournament championships. On top of that, also won 5 gold medals with USA basketball, 3 at the Olympics, 2 at the World Cup, over 1,195 wins as a coach in the NCAA. You name it, he's pretty much achieved it as a coach with Duke and in the NCAA. They finished 26-5 this year. They're projected to be a 2 seed. I think Coach K has mentioned that he was glad that all of this farewell tour is now done. The regular season is concluded. And now they get on to what the main focus is for every big program, March Madness. And we'll see if they can get it done. You know, the past couple of years, their last national championship was in 2015 against a team I'm not going to mention. But Elite Eight appearances the past couple of years, round of 32. So they haven't really got there to the Final Four in a few years or the national championship. But Duke is always a threat in the tournament. So I expect them to fully put everything they have into this. He's going to do everything he can to, you know, coach the best he can and get Duke as far as possible. And I don't think anybody's going to write them off very soon.
Yeah, I think it's about time, though, that he steps away. I know college sports kind of has that figurehead coach a lot of times. But I mean, think about it. You said he's 74, something like that. I mean, he's trying to recruit 17 and 18-year-old guys. I don't know how he can connect with them or keep up with them when he's coaching them on the court. So great career, but it's about time.
Yep. Stark, we're going to change things up in this segment. Your girl.
Yes.
Is Layla Fernandez. The 19-year-old from Laval, Quebec, defended and retained her title at the Monterey Open this past weekend. Is she the top tennis player in Canada today?
Now, it's not because she won back-to-back times at this event that she's my girl. It's because she won it like a true Canadian. She battled back in the third set after being down 4-1 to tie it at fours. Then when losing 6-5, she fought off 3 match points before play was paused. Why was it paused, you asked? Because while Layla was returning the ball close to the net, the power went out. So her opponent smashed the ball past her. The umpires discussed it and awarded the Colombian the point. What? What kind of rules are these? But did she complain? Did she smash her racket like a diva? Nope. She powered through it, forcing a tie break and winning 7-3. She's the number one tennis player in Canada and will now be leading the Canadians into the Billie Jean King Cup against Latvia this week. Go get them, Layla. You have me as a fan. Mike, your second boy. This past weekend, your boy, Sweet Swing and Fred Couples, got married. And of course, he wore his Skechers during the ceremony. He has had back problems and seemed to be enjoying the retired life at the age of 62. But does your boy, Freddie, have what it take to make the cut at the Masters next month?
I certainly hope so. It is the 30th anniversary of his Masters win in 1992. My favorite golfer of all time. I like to think I have a sweet swing as well. Don't wear the glove like Freddie. Also wear the Echo shoes. And I got to tell you, as someone who has some back problems, they're wonderful for the feet. Getting in and out of the cart. But congrats to Fred Couples. Got married, like you said, longtime girlfriend. He was set to make his debut this past weekend at the Hogue Classic, where he finished tied for second last year, but unfortunately, due to back problems, he had to withdraw. So he's yet to make his season debut. At this point, we got 4 weeks to the Masters. Take it easy. Enjoy the California sun and just prepare yourself for the Masters in 4 weeks' time.
And you know, the Masters, a tradition unlike any other. Mm. But honest to God, one of those traditions for me is seeing Fred Couples' name on the leaderboard probably around like Friday mid-morning. He's always in the mix.
Yep.
He's going to make the cut. He'll be around, you know, walking down with his gray hair, walking down right through all the fairways. And he's just smiling, having a good time, twirling his club. I like Freddie Couples too, so I'm rooting for him.
Thanks. I feel like of the people we golf with, I'm the Fred Couples of our group. I'm never going to win, probably, but we're going to have a good time.
Do you know his nickname?
Of course. Boom Boom.
Do you want me to start calling you Boom Boom or Boom Boom Junior?
Well, let's see how I do off the tee first this year. Stark, your group, so I've changed it up a bit here this week.
I like it.
But your group is Golf Canada. With success in both men's and women's golf that we've seen this year and at the grassroots level, are we destined to see more Canadian champions?
2 weeks ago, my group, Golf Canada, announced they were hoping to increase PGA and LPGA Tour players in the next 5 to 10 years. 9 men set a record for most Canadians to play in one PGA event, and Brooke Henderson, at 24, is the winningest Canadian golfer of all time. Golf Canada will expand their current program with a goal of a combined 30 players on the two tours. Then, this weekend, Katie Cranston from Oakville, Ontario, won the DJ World Junior title, while teammate Nicole Gal finished third. Meanwhile, Henderson finished T6 in Singapore at the HSBC World Championship, and Adam Cockerill finished a career-best fourth on the European Tour. The 28-year-old is currently ranked 118th in the world and will be looking to move to the PGA Tour in the coming years. Hey, Golf Canada, you're my group, and you're doing it right. Keep up the good work, and we will have major championship winners on the regular very soon.
As a fellow Golf Canada member, I agree.
Hats off to them. Yeah. Got to keep that going.
Absolutely.
Now, listen, you need to sign up with MyBookie and use the promo code JABO to make your first deposit, earning a free entry into the My Bracket contest for a chance to win a Bitcoin and over $100,000 in cash prizes. So make sure to go to mybookie.com right now, and we're going to help you out with a pick that can win you some money on mybookie.com, as each week, Mike and I will give you our best bet of the week to help you make that cash. But look, sometimes we stumble. I had Duke at home in Coach K's last game to cover, and they lost outright. Well, Mike had Rory top 10, but after a great first round, he just puked all over himself and finished 13th. Mike, I still have the tee, and I'm going to hockey. Look, the Edmonton Oilers are 2 points out of the last wild card spot in the Western Conference. They have played much better under new coach Jay Woodcroft. They lost at home on Saturday night to Montreal on hockey night in Canada, and you know that they are pissed about it. And they're not going to let it happen again. Coming Saturday, March 12th, again on hockey night in Canada, they host the Tampa Bay Lightning. I'm taking the Oilers, which will be plus money for the outright win, as McDavid will look to shine. Feel free to sprinkle a little multiple goal night for Connor McDavid as well. And that is my lock.
Canadians are playing real good right now. As much as it pains me to say this, because of our golf picks, I have to stick with him. And I'm putting Colin Morikawa at a minimum of tied for 10th. This week at the Players' Championship. He's been playing well, and he rises to the occasion in all the big tournaments. And, you know, as you said, and I agree, this is one that the players all want to win. You know, it's kind of like their major. And I think Colin is one of those guys that plays when the lights shine the brightest, and I'm taking him T10 this week. I was going to say Wisconsin, but the... You know, the 2 seed scares me, playing Purdue potentially. So,
as it should, we've talked about it. They did not win their regular season championship. So
they're co-champions. So there you go.
I do like that pick. I agree. Colin Morikawa, watch out for him this week. Have a couple good first rounds, and he'll have himself right in position. And as you mentioned, he's a killer. Come down the end of the tournament, he'll look to win.
One of the best iron players on tour.
Yeah, just like me. Now, we want to hear from you. Make sure to comment on the pod wherever you download your podcast, and let us know your thoughts on Twitter and Instagram. We would love the feedback. Check us out on Instagram and Twitter at JABOPod, thestringer.ca, and find Mike and I on Twitter to see our thoughts on all the sports throughout the week. Please subscribe, like, and rate our show, and do us a favor and tell a friend to listen. And as always, clear eyes,
full hearts.
Can't lose. Yeah.